there a doctor in the house?
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you.
Doctor.
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 And doctor.
It's time for Advanced Medicine Monday with Dr. Rashid Batar.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
I'm a doctor, not a coal miner.
The doctor is in.
All right, it's that time of the week again. Advanced Medicine on the Robert Scott Bell Show with Dr. Rashid Batar. We're going to get into what we perceive to be a flu propaganda campaign utilizing a tragic circumstance, a very tragic circumstance. And some people look at these things and they say, never let a tragedy or a crisis go to waste. We're going to get into that in just a moment. Dr. Batar, how are you, my friend?
I am doing well, Robert. How about yourself?
Yeah, as I met, we were talking a little bit over the break. A week ago, I broke a bone in my hand, and, you know, the energy's been sapped all week just a bit. You're trying to trudge through it. In fact, I did a lecture midweek, well, toward the latter part of the week, a local lecture that, you know, when you're on purpose and on mission, you find a way to overcome stuff. But I probably was not good for my healing. And then since that time, I put on a larger brace to really support the joints above and below the break. And it's really accelerated the recovery since then.
Yeah, immobilization on any type of a fracture, whether it's an angulated fracture or just a simple fracture, the immobilization of the joint is crucial to rapid healing. And it actually, the person's healthy, they'll actually pretty rapidly heal. The problem is people end up, like you, using it. But I assume if you were lecturing, you weren't like, you know, using your hands to do anything like welding or something like that.
You assume too much, my friend, because I actually took my radio equipment and set up the radio equipment to do a live broadcast, and I was just being a doofus, and I learned the hard way afterwards, like, that I shouldn't have done that. And since then, I've done the right thing.
You didn't get a hammer and then drive stakes in there to stabilize your tent and all that stuff, did you?
I did not go that far. I'm not sure if Halloween had passed yet. But no, regardless, it was bad enough. The inflammation made it scary for the kids who came to the door. But no, we're good now. I'm on the mend. Thank you. There's some serious stuff, as always, we got to cover when we do advanced medicine. And the first story you sent us, and it's about a doctor's son who died apparently 10 days before a flu shot appointment. And now this has been used as a rallying cry that everybody must get a flu shot. You don't want this to happen to your child. Now, this is a disaster. Any child that dies, our heart goes out to you. But there are some suspicions that I have. And number one on the list, if this doctor was in the United States, and we'll see if this is the case, maybe Super Don can say so. But, well, in fact, yes, they're in Texas. So tell me how in Texas there's not a drugstore on every street corner, practically the whole state, that you can't walk in without an appointment and get a flu shot anytime, and they'll give you a discount on anything you want if you do so. For this story to start with, I had an appointment for 10 days from now, and if I had just gotten in a little earlier, my son would be alive. This part of the story just strikes me, something's wrong.
Yeah, I think that was, it was, as you said, our spidey senses, our Spider-Man senses were tingling. When I read that news, that's the first thing I thought. Wait a second. I mean, I can see that. Well, you know, I've got an appointment in 10 days. I'll just go there. But the point is, a physician should know that viral influenza, you know, the flu, it's a self-limiting type of a condition. There's no drug that you can give. Yes, there's the new antivirals that have come out in the last 10 years. But prior to that, you know, the way to treat the flu is hydration, vitamin C, bed rest. That's how you treat it. And to leap to this huge conclusion that if I'd gotten my flu shot, well, wait a second, let's look at that. Even if he had gotten the flu shot 10 days earlier, and let's say that it was something with the immune response that, you know, she's hoping, or the doctor, the husband and wife, like they're both doctors, were hoping they were going to get an immune response. Are you telling me that in 10 days they're going to have enough of an IgG, IgE, IgA, IgM, IgF antibody response to protect them from, you know, and it's usually in this particular situation, you're looking probably at an IgE or IgA type antibody, immunoglobulin type response. But, you know, that takes 14 days. It's, you know, 10 to 14 days. My point is that even if they had gotten that flu shot, and even if the flu shot was really the cause of this child's death, which, as you said, you know, it's hard to go out to anybody who's just lost a child, but to leap to that conclusion that it was the flu, and then to say that the flu shot would have prevented them from actually, from this child from actually dying, I mean, that's like a massive leap.
It's an unprovable leap. It can't be proven or disproven. So to say it, it becomes a marketing slogan or campaign. And by the way, as I'm looking in Texas, apparently it's against the law to vaccinate children under 7 at these pharmacies. So, okay, maybe it wasn't that easy. But what about the doc in the box? All of those, you know, little emergency boxes that you can go to. I don't know that there's a law.
Robert, again, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I was just going to, something that came to mind, but go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that if they really needed or felt that they needed the shot, again, this is an after the fact scenario. Hey, let's take advantage of this tragic story and scare other people that this could happen to their healthy children. But again, healthy? Who defines healthy? Why should a 2-year-old die of influenza this day and age unless there are underlying conditions, excretory pathway congestion? You know, that they cannot handle the burden that happens with an immune challenge like this. We define health perhaps differently than much of the allopathic community.
Well, my question is very simple. If this child had gotten the flu shot, I am very confident that the ultimate unfortunate circumstance that occurred would have probably occurred not 10 days, but maybe 5 or 6 or 7 days. And we certainly would not have heard about this story. Nobody would be talking about the fact that the child had the vaccine and then died 7 days, 8 days, 9 days, or 10, whatever. Nobody would be hearing about that because we know that that happens all the time. Vaccine injured children constantly is happening all the time, every day. I have no idea how many times in a minute it's happening, but we do know it's happening. Do you think that this story would be talked about or discussed had the child had an adverse response after having the flu shot? And the answer
it wouldn't be used as a propaganda campaign for flu shots, of course, right? So the point is they advocate for the flu shot based on an unprovable statement that had this child, as you said, gotten it 10 days earlier, wouldn't have gotten the flu and wouldn't have died. Again, based on the amount of time it takes to respond to develop potentially antibodies that may not even match up. Again, this goes to the heart of the immaturity of the media and the medical mafia promoting a flu shot agenda that don't even acknowledge the fact that our immune systems are much more complex than having an antibody or not. You don't need an antibody to influenza to overcome it successfully and safely. There are so many other things going on. If you're really healthy, you might not even succumb to it.
That's exactly the point, that if they were healthy, if the child was healthy, they're not going to have the same negative effect as a person whose immune system is intact. You take two individuals, one that has an intact immune system, one that is frail, is nutritionally deficient, is toxic. The one that's toxic and is nutritionally deficient is not going to be able to be as resilient. Their immune system is going to have more burden on it. They're not going to respond as well and as strongly as a person who has a healthy, intact immune system. So that's really where the focus should be. And if the child had a vaccine, a flu shot, I can guarantee you that looking at their metabolic processes and looking at the toxic loads, their immune system would not have been as intact as the child was without getting that flu shot in the beginning. Because if you start looking at the additives and the preservatives and all the other stuff, the formaldehyde and the nickel and the mercury and all the DNA addicts, are you telling me that these people that are doctors, right, are you telling me that they think that having all those foreign substances, all those antigens, you can ask them, hey, do you know what a haptin is? Do you know what an antigen is? Having all this extra garbage in the body, you think that that's going to end up helping your child, their immune system being more intact? Or is that going to be a load on the child? And
well,
if they're really physicians, they're going to know the answer.
And Dr. Batar, here's where we should also make a distinction in terms of our focal point in terms of response or prevention. We're never into boosting the immune system, are we? We look to modulate immunity. We want the immune system to be more efficient at what it does. We don't need to hyperstimulate. In fact, it's argued that the vaccination itself and many of these vaccines are charging the immune system into hyperfunctional states where they are overreacting and even creating autoimmune reactions. In other words, the immune system begins to attack the cells of self. So if anybody is doing the wrong thing, it is those that are advocating these toxic injections.
That's exactly right, because the adjuvants, those things that they call adjuvants, they are actually designed to create a stimulatory effect on the immune system to get a hyperimmune response. And the problem is that when you're creating a hyperimmune response in conjunction with giving substances that are immunosuppressive, it's like having a person in the middle of two trucks that are pulling on the opposite sides. You're driving, you know, you're driving forces on opposite extremes, and so net effect is you're going to tear the system apart. I mean, you're going to, if I have a truck tied to my right arm, my left arm, and you're pulling it either way, you're going to tear that system apart. It's not designed to work that way. First of all, and then Secondly, as you said, when you hyper stimulate and the immune system, you're driving the system into a certain arena where you don't need to drive it. You're whipping a horse, although the horse is tied. You're whipping a horse to go right, even though you've got it tied down so you can't go to the right or to the left. So now what are you going to do? You're going to exhaust that immune system. You're going to drive it into the ground. And you're also, without even realizing it, what they're doing is when they're driving that immune system into a hyper-responsive state, then the body's other mechanisms that are designed to function in a certain balance, you create a compensatory type response. So the body responds in a hyper-attenuated, there's all these changes that occur because you've created a sympathetic mimetic reaction. You've created a stressful reaction. So now your adrenal glands are firing. You've got B vitamins and minerals that are being burned at an excessive rate because your body's in a stressful situation, which now prevents the body from having the nutrients and the supplies that it needs to build an immune response. So it's completely going in the wrong direction.
And then, Dr. Bitar, as this child unfortunately was in a hospital, what does the hospital do in such cases of triage? Do they not suppress the symptoms? Do they not also compromise the liver and the excretory organs? Could they not be complicit, not intentionally, I don't mean they mean to, but complicit in the down functioning of a body that was responding appropriately, that if it was modulated as opposed to suppressed or hyperexcited by the vaccination, as they're arguing for everybody else, could this have turned out differently? We're not playing Monday morning quarterback. We're giving you principles to consider long before a tragedy like this would ever happen to you or any other children. Stick with us. Lots more to go.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?
The Robert Scott Bell Show. Information is so good, it requires no expiration date. The Robert Scott Bell Show.
All right, thank y'all for being here. Robert Scott Bell Show, Advanced Medicine Hour 2 on Monday. If you're listening and watching live, also on YouTube, Dr. Bitar has got it streaming out through his Facebook feed as well. And, of course, GCN, our home and broadcast radio syndication. I was mentioning about what happens when you go to a hospital, the triage thing. You know, we've acknowledged that life and death can be in the balance when you're in an ER room with severe symptoms, particularly with, you know, accidents, physical trauma. But with influenza and the immune response, the things that they do in allopathic medicine can be counterproductive, Dr. Bitar, or am I exaggerating?
No, they can certainly be counterproductive. So the use of immunosuppressive drugs to reduce the inflammatory cascade, to reduce that massive immune surge, which the vaccine is designed to do in this particular case, in this scenario. But, you know, you've got a lot of inflammation, the trauma, the penetrating trauma, lung trauma. With any type of situation with this mass inflammation, the use of steroids is a standard part of the treatment protocol. So they want to tone down the immune system so it doesn't cause that massive inflammatory cascade. The problem is now, again, you know, you've got this immune system that you're giving these adjuvants to. Now you give the steroids, which is going to suppress the immune system. It's going to suppress other aspects of the immune system, too, that weren't designed to be stimulated by the vaccine aspect. Because remember, the vaccine is trying to stimulate the antibody response, which is specifically limited to the CD19 or the B lymphocyte. But you've got other components, too, in the immune system. You've got the CD3, CD4, CD16, CD56, you know, you've got the macrophages, and you've got all these other types of white blood cells. So when you're doing an antibody response, you're really stimulating the B lymphocytes, which produce the antibodies. But so you've got that particular part of the issue that you got to deal with now because of what the hospitals are going to do, which, again, is a standard thing. If you've got penetrating trauma or you've got blunt trauma, you know, you do need to help suppress that massive cascade of inflammation. But, again, you know how against the use of Ceradiem in a non-trauma situation. As far as I'm concerned, in a non-traumatic situation, there is no place for steroids at all. Even in, like, poison ivy cases and some of these things, you know, if it's extreme and the person is causing a problem where it's causing impending airway or breathing issues, then perhaps just use it for temporary for a day or two. But then I don't. Even then, I'm very. There's other things that we can do that we do. But then on top of that, if you're in a hospital situation, then you've got the other issue of nosocomial infections, which are drug-resistant bacteria, viruses, pathogens. You've heard about the MRSA, right? Methyl-resistant Staph aureus. Staph aureus is everywhere, but methyl-resistant Staph aureus is a type of Staph aureus, it's a common bacteria, that is resistant to antibiotics. So then it causes all sorts of problems. So now you've got these nosocomial infections, these infections that are resistant to the normal antibiotic regimen that the child is being exposed to, that the patient's being exposed to, on top of the fact that giving the child immunosuppressants. I mean, you know, the safest place is not the hospital in a situation like this. It's a sad thing to say, but when a person is sick, I've had other doctors tell me this themselves. You know, when you get sick, the most dangerous place is the hospital. You don't necessarily want to go to the hospital. Now, again, I'm saying that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I'm not saying that totally sarcastically, because if a person is immunocompromised, you don't want that person in the hospital because they will die from an infection. It's guaranteed.
I mean, well, and how many times does a child get brought to the ER? And the first thing they ask is this child up to date on all vaccinations? So you're in the throes of a devastating cytokine storm, and then you give mercury and aluminum-laden vaccines. Maybe they respond with Tamiflu. Maybe they respond with Tylenol for fever, which is the most liver-toxic drug that you can imagine. You add to the mix, and you go, I think it's very plausible and not an exaggeration, the least, that this tragedy could have been averted had this child not gone to the hospital. And again, I wasn't there, so I'm not saying definitively, but based on what we know of how they respond and react, they could be culpable in the death of this child, not in absence of a flu shot.
Well, Robert, I will just go on to say that if you look at the statistics as published by John Hopkins, the third leading cause of death in the industrialized world, I think specifically in the U.S., again,
yes.
This is not some random, study that was done by a non-recognized entity. This is John Hopkins, which is considered to be the number one medical school in the United States. As published by John Hopkins in the New England Journal of Medicine, I believe it was, or it may have been in JAMA, I can't remember which journal, but either one of those two are very prominent medical journals in the U.S.
Yep.
And both of these, the third leading cause of death is iatrogenic causes. Causes of death that are due to doctor-induced issues.
Well, and that's why we do advanced medicine each and every week, to get you beyond it, above and beyond it. We got a lot more healing to go. We'll talk about heavy metals' impact on cholesterol levels, why you should or should not care. Also, skin cancer updates, too.
Can you repeat the part of the stuff where you said all about the things?
It's the Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert, we'll be right back.
Robert Scott Bell Show.
It is advanced medicine time. Dr. Batar and I talk about some things that you won't hear anywhere else in broadcast media, and certainly not in this way. And, you know, we talked the whole first half of the show with you about the flu shot propaganda, the tragedies and how they are used to propagandize people. And, you know, another propaganda campaign in the 20th century was the propaganda campaign against cholesterol and fat. And that the idea was that we needed to now move all into carbs. And, of course, what replaced cardboard to make it taste good was sugar. More carbs. And it created a disaster. And, of course, that ultimately would elevate cholesterol, interestingly enough, in maybe a way that is not indicative of the danger of cholesterol per se, but of its protective nature. But I've got an interesting question about this next story, because it relates to cholesterol, which we know is not the cause of heart disease. But they're saying, with lead and mercury exposure, that they have measured elevated levels of cholesterol. Why could that be the case?
Well, it could be possibly because cholesterol is trying to protect the body, so it's a hyperimmune response from the oxidative stress caused by the lead and the mercury. In other words, the mechanism of action of toxicity. I know, Robert, that was a rhetorical question, but I think I'll take the opportunity to answer it anyway.
Yes.
Because the lead and the mercury, their mechanism of action is through oxidation or oxidative injury, also known as the reduction reaction in chemistry. And it causes a phenomenon called lipid peroxidation. And lipid peroxidation is where the cell membrane basically gets chewed up and becomes friable, and it causes massive damage. And the micro injuries that are taking place on the epithelial wall, on the vascular tree, within the vascular tree, the body is trying to protect those microvascular damages that where that lipid peroxidation is taking place. So what it does is it lays a groundwork, like a patch, if you will, or a band-aid, and it consists of fibrin and fibrinogen and calcium, which acts as the framework of the matrix, and the cholesterol comes in and covers it all up. And over time, it builds up and builds up and builds up. It's like a callus is what it is, trying to protect those areas that have microvascular damage. And that's what leads to atheroma formation or atherosclerosis, and that's where heart disease starts. Now, when you go in and you do a bypass operation, you know, you do a CABG, coronary artery bypass graft, you cut that vessel, and now you take out the plaque and you take out the segment that's what they call disease and then put it back together, then you would think that if microvascular damage over time causes this plaque formation, then when you go in and you cut the vessel, that's a macrovascular damage. It's not micro anymore. So you would think that it would actually get worse faster. And that's exactly what happens. The New England Journal of Medicine published this in the 1980s, that after bypass, the rate of atheroma formation, the rate of blockage in the vascular tree increases.
Goes up.
Tenfold. That's 1,000%.
You've created a massive inflammatory cascade that just doesn't quit, not that easily. And
exactly.
Dr. Batari, you never, I don't know how to say it. Do you never underestimate the stupidity of doctors, or don't you can't overestimate the stupidity of doctors? Because I'm reading this article about the mercury levels and lead levels, and it's interesting. I mean, there's nothing wrong with what they've identified. My gosh, we see higher cholesterol levels when we see higher heavy metal levels in the body. Okay, fine. What is your takeaway from this? Well, their takeaway is, my goodness, we really need to maybe direct people to cardiovascular doctors to get them on cholesterol-lowering medication because their risk for cardiovascular disease has now gone up because of the cholesterol, not the heavy metals.
But it's the same thing, the same argument that I've said so many times to you. I have observed that every time there is a fire, there is a presence of fire engines. Therefore, I conclude that fire engines cause fires. It's preposterous. It just doesn't. It defies logic. But this is what they're doing. They're trying to blame this issue on the lead and mercury. But lead and mercury causes microvascular damage, and the cholesterol is coming in response to try to salvage the situation. And it's, I mean, this is a basic physiological concept. It's a premise that is, you know, it's like you have to learn the letters A, B, C before you can put words together and write a message or write a letter or anything, right? You have to first know the basics of the alphabet. This is the basics of the inflammatory cascade that we're taught in medical school. Yet they're trying to say that lead and mercury causes greater cholesterol levels. Well, it's causing an increase in cholesterol mobilization to try to deal with the microvascular damage because there's more need of Band-Aid. There's more need of trying to patch this area. That's why it's so important to take out the causation, to take out the factor that's causing this, which is the heavy metal, to prevent the lipid peroxidation.
No discussion of where's the source of these heavy metals, let's clean that up. No discussion of let's make sure we get enough selenium and other things in their system to counteract it. No discussion of intravenous chelation in an acute scenario that really is going to pull these things out faster than anything you can, you normally would need to, for instance. No, it's about, we've got to worry about the risk of heart disease because of elevated cholesterol levels. Listen, cardiology as it's practiced today, if they still believe cholesterol is the cause of heart disease, it's one of the main reasons why I call it a medical degree. I mean, these people are not using the intelligence God may have been given to the, given them.
Well, it's interesting that when you start looking at, you know, you said that there's no addressing the causation. Where's the load of heavy metal exposure coming from? Then the problem is you'd have to start talking about the amalgam load. You'd have to start talking about
mercury and vaccines.
In the vaccines, exactly, the consistency of the vaccines. You'd have to start talking about, you know, the quality of the air that we're breathing, and you'd have to start talking about all these other exposures of heavy metals. You know, you've got gas. When you're actually pumping gas in your car, you're breathing in many of these vapors, lead, cadmium, and mercury. But the vast amount of exposure, I mean, the worst type of exposure is actually through inhalation, but the mass level of exposure is actually between inhalation of vapor as well as the vaccine that develops an amalgam load. But notice the area that we really concentrate on, when I say we, I mean the public, the media covers, it's the fish. It's in the fish, the level of mercury in fish. They don't, which represents, that's the methyl mercury anyway. That may be maybe 5-10% of the issue. So what about the other 90% of the exposure? Nobody talks about that.
And a significant part of that exposure is due to medical intervention, dental and medical. It's what they're doing to you. So they don't want you to know and identify it. Although this is amazing. This got published, as you know, anytime mercury is mentioned, it may or may not, but especially if they reference the term autism, which in this case they haven't. But cholesterol, it's okay. We want you to worry about cholesterol. By the way, somebody asked, will natokinase reduce cholesterol? I don't know that you need to, but the point of natokinase is kind of an enzyme to help prevent clots and different things to thin the blood, not like a rat poison or Coumadin, but that's a kind of a dietary supplement way of addressing it without poisoning your liver and kidneys. All right.
Natokinase and streptokinase, and there's many different types of things that you can actually use to help to increase decrease the viscosity and increase the flexibility of the red blood cells. Natural ginger is a great way.
Great way to do it too. Yeah, and stop chasing cholesterol. If it's abnormally high or low, if they've challenged you over the years to find out something's aberrant has gone on, look to what's inputting in your diet, your lifestyle, your environment, what could be impacting and stressing the liver, as in this case, heavy metals impacting oxidative stress and damage to cells. All right, can we move to the skin cancer story? Are you up for doing that?
Well, not yet. How much time do you have? Because the important thing about cholesterol that I want to bring up, okay?
Okay, go ahead. We got 3 minutes or so in this segment.
All right, so cholesterol, I'm just telling you guys my own personal story. Up until I was my second and third year in medical school, I was told that I had a problem with cholesterol. I have a type 2B hyperlipidemia, which is a genetic lesion. My mom had cholesterol levels, you know, the 1500s. Mine were 2000, 2500. My triglycerides were in the 1500s. I actually was put on a statin drug at the end of my third year, beginning my fourth year of medical school, and I lasted maybe for 2 weeks. I stopped it. I couldn't lift anymore. There was so much, you know, there was weakness. All sorts of weird things started happening. And my cholesterol, I realized that, you know, I was told I can't drink any more milk, I need no more whole milk. I just drink a gallon of whole milk, you know, don't stop eating eggs. You know, Robert, if I get 2 eggs a day, and as long as I'm doing my exercise, my lipids are probably anywhere from 250 to 400, 500. They used to be in the 2,000, 2,500. My cholesterol was so high, and I've actually got on the cardiovascular DVD, Know Your Options, I've got before and after examples of cholesterol level, and those tests are actually of mine. Okay, those are my tests.
You should be in the Guinness Book of World Records for like 2,000 lipid levels.
No, it's Robert, when my staff would draw blood, they would be about one third of the top of the test tube, one fourth to one third of the test tube was pure fat. It was pure
fat. Wow.
It's just like the grease that you see. That's how bad it used to be. But I've completely changed it based on two things, diet and exercise. And that's all it is. It's all related to sugar. And the cholesterol that you're worried about is actually the body's way of protecting the system. You reduce the sugar and you increase your exercise, Now, whenever in the last five, probably the last 8 years, whenever they draw my blood, it's totally normal. There's no layer of fat at the top. And I've been on a statin except for those 2 weeks when I was, you know, without medical school, which was 26, 27 years ago.
Dr. Bitar, you know, you've shared a lot of things, personal stories over the years. I'm thinking this may be the most dangerous thing you've ever shared because if, as Liam Sheff had posited, that we are in the era of peak oil and oil becomes less and less available, they're going to come to you, Dr. Bitar, and say, whatever lifestyle you used to lead, go back on that because we need to get oil from your blood to keep this thing going.
Maybe so. Maybe so. But oil, you know, types of fat, the right types of fat are good. And remember, cholesterol, it's demonized, but cholesterol in the wrong place is the problem. Cholesterol, normally, it's a precursor of all the sex hormones. Without cholesterol, we would be an organic heap of mush. Cholesterol is vital to cell membrane integrity. So don't forget, cholesterol serves a very important purpose in our lives. And dietary cholesterol is only about 5% relevant. 95% is already in our system. It's not what we're
doing. Keep eating your pastured, free-range, organic eggs. You're not going to elevate your cholesterol levels, impacted at all, really at all. So, folks, again, what's that?
You drop your cholesterol level.
Yeah, there's a biofeedback loop in the body. It says, oh, we're getting it from there. We don't need to produce as much. Folks, stop fearing cholesterol. And I still am annoyed by all of our friends in the natural products industry that are selling products to lower cholesterol. Focus on liver health, hydration, mineralization, obviously removing heavy metals. Stop with the cholesterol. You've been duped. You've been lied to, and you're still parroting back. Remember when I said how your thoughts are not your own? Fearing cholesterol, you weren't born with that fear. It was taught. We'll be back to talk skin cancer for a final segment with Dr. Bitar here.
Live around the world,
the Robert Scott Bell Show.
Robert Scott Bell.
Willing to go where the truth takes him, here's Robert.
All right, if you ever miss a show, plenty of places to go to catch them later or share them with your friends. Right here in GCN, GCNlive.com, or home and broadcast radio syndication. Later on, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, UK Health Radio. I know Guy Fawkes Day is coming 2 days late for you listening to the show, but also AdvancedMedicine.com, which we used to have MedicalRewind.com. We'll have access to all of the archives of Advanced Medicine. Dr. Bitar and I have done hundreds and hundreds of hours of shows together, and they never expire. They never go bad. Other than if we mention an event that will come and go. But other than that, all good, even today. Dr. Bitar, we've talked about a lot of things today. We didn't mention the IDFW. Those of you who want to find out more at AdvancedMedicine.com, get out of the public health sector, become part of a private association. The invitation code is 1358 for the Robert Scott Bell Show listeners. Anything you want to add to that before we go into our final story about skin cancer?
Well, actually, I'll wait till you bring up the story about skin cancer because it'll tie right back to the IADFW here in a second.
Okay. So the headline reads, skin cancer death rates soar, mostly for men, according to this latest study. Skin cancer among men soaring in wealthy nations since 1985, mortality rates in women rising slower than or even declining compared to men. What is going on, and is it the sun that has suddenly turned evil since 1985, Dr. Bitar?
And, of course, selectively in men. It's turned evil selectively in men. So, you know, the thing is that I think that when you start talking about increase in skin cancer, but you can look at any kind of cancer, there's been an increase in all cancers. Because there's an increase in toxicity on our planet, there's a decrease as far as the nutritional value of the foods that we ingest. So you have less resources that the body needs in order to have an intact and healthy immune system. And then we have more burden on our systems, not only burdens that we're being exposed to, but burdens that are sometimes introduced into our bodies, thinking that we're doing the right thing. Preventive medicine is a perfect example, right? Preventive medicine, the idea of preventive medicine in the medical community is to get vaccines. So this is called prevention, and actually you're contributing to a toxic load in the system. And so that all throws off the balance in the body, and it leads to increase in all types of cancer and all types of pathology, heart disease, everything. In skin cancer specifically, you know, there's a very important component. I tell my patients they need 20 minutes of sunlight every day. I recommend and encourage people to take off their shirt, you know, pull up your pants, get as much sun exposure as you can for at least 20 minutes in the day. And the reason this is important is because of vitamin D absorption and calcium absorption. Vitamin D is necessary for calcium absorption. Robert, I can't believe this. They actually just froze me out of Facebook again. I'm just being conspiratorial there.
Yes, of course. Well, anytime we talk favorably about the sun and all the good that it does for you rather than causing cancer, which it does not. Again, in the presence of ionizing radiation without adequate minerals to defend against the oxidative stress and damage, that's different, but that's not caused by the sun. It's caused by what you just said, the food devoid of the things that are needed to protect our healthy cells and maintain their health.
And that's why you need that sunlight, because sunlight is a major component in the presence of vitamin D to help the body absorb calcium. Calcium in the right places is essential for life. In the wrong places, it's pathognomonic, meaning that it will cause disease. Calcium inside of the vascular tree, calcium inside of joints, calcium inside of, you know, this is where tenosynovitis and arthritis and cardiovascular disease and old granulomatous disease of the lungs, because calcium is going in the wrong places. But calcium absorption, correct calcium absorption, is important to make sure that we're maintaining that cascade in the right direction. And that is what's needed to make sure that happens is vitamin D3 in the presence of sunlight. So
right.
That's an important part. I recommend that to all my patients, especially my cancer patients, they need 20 minutes of sun. And so I figure you're going to bring up Chris's story?
Yeah, real quick, because we're almost out of time, believe it or not. But I know that you have a cancer patient who was skin cancer, melanoma, and he's alive and well today, all these years later. It wasn't caused by the skin. It was where the sun wasn't shining.
Right. And we've had a number of melanoma patients. Chris was given 6 months to live by Cleveland Clinic, and Mayo said, he had a year if they took his leg. He has his leg. That was 10 years ago. And for the IADSW members at the International Association for a Disease-Free World, Chris just posted there a couple of days ago, so you can talk to him directly and ask him his story.
Very nice.
Story. Awesome guy.
Beautiful. So, y'all, another reason to join the IADFW. I think you get it for $1 for life instead of $99 a year. Or like, I don't know what it is. But anyway, it's super cheap. But it's worth so much more. It's so valuable. Thank you, Dr. Mattar. Tell them what they need to know because it's time to go.
Thank you, Robert. The power to heal is unequivocally yours.
The Robert Scott Bell Show.